As I was saying, I want to thank you for praying for me and for all of those who graciously filled in for me after last week. I want to thank Ben and Kyle and Al Lyon and others who helped to fill in a moment's notice. If you happened to miss last week, you missed a very interesting and short message. If you were here, you now know why we do not broadcast our services live on the internet. As my message was suddenly curtailed by the stomach flu, and as I went out into the hallway, I think Keith and Dwayne and Dawn were out there, and Dawn asked me the most important question of the moment, which was not, are you okay, but is that microphone turned off? And thankfully, I was thinking the same thing, because I've heard all these horror stories, but thankfully the mic was not on. Last week was actually supposed to be part one of a two-part message, and it turned out to be part one half, basically, which means I have a lot to share with you today. The gentleman who came up after me and spoke actually took care of some of that, but I want to take a minute and sum up what we talked about. We have been looking for the last 3 weeks or so at John chapter 1, verse 17, which I've called our Christmas memory verse, and it simply says this, "For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." The law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And we were talking last week especially about this concept of grace, which we defined as unmerited favor. Something good that happens to you or that you receive, even though you did not do anything to earn it or to deserve it. That's grace. And we talked about how the law, and that's kind of a loaded word, but we talked about all those Old Testament commandments, and last week we talked about the Ten Commandments in particular. We said the law is sometimes set up as an enemy of grace. There's law on one hand and grace on the other, but that's not how the Bible presents it. In fact, the law sets us up for grace by showing us how impossible it is to please God on our own efforts. And in that way, Moses kind of sets us up for Jesus, because the law sets us up for grace. Then we saw that while the law was given, came down as a message delivered through Moses, it was different with grace. The law was given, but grace actually came in person. Jesus was not just a person with a message about grace. He was, in fact, an expression of grace. As the hymn writer said, he was the dawn of redeeming grace. He was grace in living color. He was grace in action. And I had a lot more I was going to say about that last week, but let me just skip most of it and cut to the chase. Because when Jesus showed up on the human scene, when Jesus came in person, he began to do certain things. He began to reach out to people who were helpless. He began to do miracles for unclean people like lepers and people that were demon-possessed. And he began to include in his circle of friends tax collectors and prostitutes and all sorts of other people that were thought to be on the down and out or the dregs of society. And he said things too. He said things like, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, "Come unto me, all you who are sick and tired of trying like crazy to measure up all the time, and I will give you rest for your souls." And when Jesus did these things and said these things, he was being very radical, revolutionary even. It was kind of like the rules of the universe had instantly changed. There was suddenly room in the family of God for people who didn't belong there. And some of you remember Ashley's beautiful testimony at the beginning of the service last week where she said that she just felt like she didn't belong. But that's where we are before we come to Christ. That's where we are when Jesus accepts us, the ones who don't belong. That's grace. Meanwhile, the people who think that they do belong so often end up on the outside looking in. That happened in Jesus' time too. Well, what had happened? What had happened? Grace had happened. Grace had dawned. Grace was here. Grace came in person in living color. And here's the important thing, grace is still here today. Grace is here today because Jesus is still here today through the person of his Holy Spirit and also through the testimony of his people, the church. Grace is still here. Grace is still being offered. And that's great news, but not for everybody. Because as we talked about last week, some people struggle with grace. Why would people struggle with grace? Why would people struggle to get something good that they didn't deserve? Well, grace forces us to live in a world where the numbers don't add up. That's hard for some people. For those of us who like to compare ourselves to others and maybe give ourselves a score for holiness or goodness and rejoice just a little bit that we're kind of better than them, grace forces us to totally give up on that idea. For those of us who like to earn our way to everything and pay for everything, pay for our own privileges and never be in debt to anyone, grace forces us to go to a place where our money is no good. We're helpless. And for those of us who like to insist on absolute fairness and justice all the time in life, grace puts us in a very strange world where we will forever be frustrated because with grace, the wrong people are always getting VIP treatment. And the spiritual freeloaders are always living high on the hog. And that irks us. Until we realize that the only way to live in this world and the only way to benefit from the situation is to admit that we too are among the freeloaders. Because we don't have a leg to stand on either. And then we ask for help. So I ask you this, can you live in that world? Can you live in a world where you can take absolutely no credit for all the good things that ever happened to you? Can you live there? Can you live in a place where you have no control over the way things are done and you have absolutely no leverage, no influence, no way to manipulate the person who is in control? Are you willing to come to God and just say, you know, I admit that I don't belong here, God, because I am a miserable sinner. I throw myself completely on your mercy, and I ask for you to let me in by the blood of your son, Jesus, who voluntarily came and died for me and who paid the entry fee for me. I have nothing to bring but my empty hands and his name. If that's where you are, then I have good news. Because Jesus says you're poor in spirit. And Jesus says if you're poor in spirit, then you're blessed because God is pleased to give you the whole kingdom. You're the people who don't belong but are going to get in. And if you answer his call even today, he will surely come into your life. He will forgive you of every single sin, past, present, and future, and he will give you eternal life that never ends. It's a wonderful promise. But then here's the challenge that goes with it. It stands to reason that anyone who is able to receive this grace should also be able to give it to other people. You heard Al talk about that some last week. As God has given grace to us, we should now have room in our hearts to give grace to others. Well, what does that look like? Because that sounds like it might be hard. Well, sometimes it comes out in really simple ways, just what we call being gracious, overlooking offenses when people get under your skin. Giving people room to be themselves and permission to just be less than perfect when you're around them. Offering forgiveness instead of judgment. Putting up with annoyances. Taking extra time maybe to sit and talk to someone who you know is not okay. Listening more than lecturing. Yikes. Dealing graciously with family members at Christmas time. And holiday shoppers. And holiday drivers. Other times, grace means taking the initiative. It means going out of your way to meet a need that you see, to pay a visit, to offer a ride, to speak a word of encouragement, to do some not-so-random act of kindness. That's what grace looks like. And in all these diverse ways, the people that are able to receive grace, the family of God, should be the ones giving grace. Okay, end of review. Well, we need that for the end of today, so I wanted to make sure we had that in the back of our mind. For now, I want to step back for a minute. I want to look at the other big word in our memory verse, which is truth. Truth. Moses brought the law, but Jesus brings truth. Well, what does that mean? Why does Jesus have to bring truth if Moses brought us the law? Was Moses telling lies? Is the law untrue? No, the law is full of truth. The law is perfectly true. Then what was missing that Jesus had to supply when it comes to truth? Let's consider this. Is it possible that just as Moses was setting us up for Jesus when it came to grace, just as the Old Testament law was setting us up for New Testament grace, maybe it's possible that the Old Testament law that Moses brought is somehow setting us up for New Testament truth as well? I want to show you a picture, and I want you to try to identify this person. Ready? Here it comes. All right. I took the label off so you wouldn't know for sure, and you have to guess, and maybe the experts here will get it. Who is that person? That's not Aunt Jemima. Good try. That is Mrs. Butterworth. That's right. Mrs. Butterworth. How many people have Mrs. Butterworth in their cabinets? Some of you do, okay? Maybe it's not that popular a brand anymore, but Mrs. Butterworth is a brand of pancake syrup. And it is a rather unusual product because it involves a container shaped like a person. Vaguely shaped like a person in this case, okay? But it's a container shaped like a person, and that's always been kind of its trademark look. Whenever you get Mrs. Butterworth, it looks like that. Now, as weird as it sounds, and I know it sounds weird, I want you to keep Mrs. Butterworth in mind as you consider how the law of Moses set us up for the truth of Jesus, okay? It's the first time that sentence has ever been spoken, probably. Because if you think about it, the law, and I'm not just speaking of the Ten Commandments now, I'm thinking of the whole first five books of the Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy, the whole law, the Hebrew Torah, the law is basically a container. Now, it is an empty container, but it's a container that is shaped like a person. Think about some of the stuff that happens in the Old Testament. Think about Abraham being willing to go sacrifice his son Isaac on the top of Mount Moriah. Think about the slaughter of the Passover lamb and the exodus from Egypt that night. Think about the crossing of the Red Sea. Think about the manna falling from the sky for the Israelites to eat when they were starving. And think about the water coming out of that rock, gushing forth for them to drink when they were thirsty. Think about all that stuff that happened in those books. All those great events that happened in the Old Testament were looking ahead to something. Something. Now think about the tabernacle. This is a place where the Hebrews came to worship God, and they had an altar of incense, and they had a table of showbread, and there was a lampstand, and there was a continual burnt offering out front, and a lot of other things that were symbols of something. What were they symbols of? Something was coming. Look at the Hebrew calendar. If you look through Leviticus and you look at the holidays in the Hebrew calendar, you're going to find out there are seven big holidays there, but they're clumped up in weird ways throughout the calendar. It's not like there's one every month. There's like three here and two here and four. And so it's very strange why it would be like that. What's up with these holidays in the Hebrew calendar? The Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Pentecost, First Fruits, Day of Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles. It had to be obvious to the Israelites in the Old Testament that these special events were symbolic of something. Some actual events that one day would take place, but hadn't yet. Now, when Jesus arrived on the scene, he showed us that the something to which the whole Old Testament pointed was actually a someone. It was a person, and it was him. All that history, all that religious ritual, all those holidays were good. They were actually fulfilled in Jesus Christ. The entire Old Testament, in many ways, was just a container that was shaped exactly like a person. And in the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, and in his continuing life today, God fills that with substance. The law is an incredibly powerful outline, but it's just that, it's an outline. It's a container. Jesus filled everything up, the holidays, the symbols, the stories, and of course the commandments as well. He did it all. He was the meaning behind all of it. So just like grace, truth happened. Jesus was and is the truth. He said it himself. He filled up the person-shaped container that the Old Testament had formed. The law had set it up. Jesus had fulfilled it. But he didn't stop there, and this is where it starts to get to us, and this is where it starts to bother us a little bit, because Jesus wasn't just truth in theory, he was truth in action. Let me explain that. Jesus, just as he went around showing grace to people and doing gracious things and including people that weren't included and all that, Jesus also went around pointing out truth. And he had a very disturbing habit of digging beneath the surface of things to find out what was really going on with people. And he pointed out people's hypocrisy. And he pointed out their motives. And he called attention to their hidden sins. And if Jesus' demonstration of grace made people uncomfortable, imagine what it was like when he started talking about truth. His quest for truth made them even more disturbed, because there were so many people in Jesus' time, not that there are any people like this today, but there are so many people in Jesus' time who had learned to play the religious game. They were fine with the animal sacrifices. They were fine with the feasting on some holidays and fasting on other holidays. They were fine with the tithes and offerings. They were fine with not doing this on the Sabbath and not doing that on the Sabbath. They were fine with all that stuff. They could handle it. They could kind of figure it out. But now this Jesus guy is here, and he is interrupting my well-crafted religious life. Think about it. I'll wash my hands all day long if someone tells me to. But don't ask me to wash my heart, right? Don't you dare imply that something is wrong with me on the inside. How dare you? That's what's happening here. Truth is very scary. And we have our own religious practices today, maybe different ones. We have our church attendance, we have our giving, we have our Bible studies, we have our potlucks. We have our Christmas candles, you know. But those things are all a container that is supposed to hold Jesus. And if you really believe that he is the truth about God, the truth about heaven, the truth about sin, the truth about right and wrong, if you believe that Jesus is the truth about all that stuff, then you also have to believe what he said about you and me. Because he showed us the truth about ourselves too, and we have to accept that. So just as I asked you about grace, are you willing to live in a world of truth? Are you willing to take off your mask and face the reality about who you really are beneath all the layers of good manners and gracious smiles and dignified behavior that we all have? That's a tough world to live in. Why would I want to face my own pride, my own selfishness, my own hyper-competitiveness, my own prejudice, my own greed, my own fear, my own smoldering anger, my own desire for revenge, my own unforgiveness and bitterness? Why would I want to face with all that stuff, all the other twisted things that are residing in my heart? Why would I want to look at those? You say, well, Jesus wants to get in there and fix you. Well, forget it. I don't want to be fixed. It's not worth it. What in the world would convince me to open up the lock on this putrid dumpster here? Ready for the answer? Grace. Grace. When I know, this is the key, when I know there's real forgiveness available, then I know I have permission to own up to my sin. When I know there's real help available, when I know that the person asking me to open up actually proved his love for me by suffering for me horribly, then maybe, just maybe, I will find the courage to take off my mask and face the truth. That's true when I got saved. I had to do that. I had to face the truth about who I was and what I had done. And it's true every single time Jesus pulls off another layer and starts to work on it in my life. It's true for me. It's true for you. And here's the other weird thing. It's true for all the people in your life that you know, which is important, because this is even harder. But just like we Jesus followers, as grace receivers, we're supposed to be grace givers and administer grace to others. So those of us who have faced the truth about ourselves or are learning how to do that, guess what? We're supposed to be helping other people do that too. And that's really tricky, right? How do you do that? Let me hit you with a little case study on this one. This is a lady that you know, not in the church, don't. It's a lady that you know in the Bible, okay? She appears in John chapter 4. You can turn there if you want. I'm not going to read the story, but we usually know her as the woman at the well. She probably has a name. One day you'll probably meet her in heaven. You'll get to ask her name. It's not the woman at the well. I'm sure she's got a name. But Jesus has a fascinating conversation with this woman, and I love this passage because it's so down to earth, and it's so real. So like I said, you can turn there. It's John 4, or you can just kind of listen to the story, because this lady here that is pictured, she has some serious issues. She's got some real issues with the opposite sex. She either has worse taste in men than Taylor Swift, or she's part of the problem, right? Or probably both. She has burned through 5 husbands already. She's currently living with a guy she's not married to. And Jesus, going in, knows all this stuff. He knows it. But notice, he doesn't start by saying, "Hey, girlfriend, you got some issues." He doesn't start that there. What does he do? Well, first he just starts a conversation with her. You know, can I have a drink of water? And by doing this, he's already breaking through two cultural barriers. One is she's a woman and he's not supposed to talk to her. One is she's a Samaritan and he's not supposed to talk to her because he's a Jew. So he's through that, and something odd is already going on here. And by the way, in this conversation, the woman gets a little bit testy with him. She starts giving him some of these, who do you think you are type questions, and he's probably thinking, who do I think I am? I'll tell you that later, but, you know. And he's very patient with her sarcasm, but in this discussion, they're talking about water. And as Jesus conducts the discussion, at one point he says this, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, he says, hey, speaking of water, I've got something I want to give you. It's a kind of water that is better than the stuff that comes out of Jacob's well. It's living water. And if you drink it, you will never be thirsty again. Now, what did he just dangle in front of her? Grace. Grace. The whole context of this conversation is Jesus has offered to give her something free and something good that she didn't deserve or earn. And grace piques her interest. She's like, okay, I'll bite. Give me some of this water. So now Jesus knows he's got her, so he says, now he thinks it's free to open up the truth part of the conversation, right? And so he says, okay, go get your husband. And she kind of awkwardly says, oh, I'm not married. And Jesus says, I know. In fact, I know your whole story. I know about all six guys. And here's where the woman at the well could very easily say, you know what? This discussion is over. Have a nice day. But she doesn't, because somehow she senses that she's still in a safe place. And so instead she goes sideways and she takes refuge in a conversation about religion. Ever have a conversation about religion with your coworkers? That's hard, right? But you know what? It's easier to talk about religion than it is to talk about the truth. And so she talks about religion, and she brings up a controversy about what mountain you're supposed to worship on, because the Jews and the Samaritans had some controversy about that. So she asks them the question, and she tries to kind of get them off on that tangent. Today she might say, what do you think people should wear to church? Should we sing hymns or praise choruses? What do you think about speaking in tongues in a worship service? She could answer any of these, she could ask any of these questions, but she's not really quite ready to hear the truth yet. Jesus answers her religious question. And then he tells her that the question will soon be completely irrelevant. It won't matter, because God wants people to worship him in spirit and in truth. In other words, we need to look beyond your religious questions, and we need to find truth. And by the way, truth is a person. As a matter of fact, truth is the person that is talking to you right now. And he tells her who he is, and she believes him. And then she runs off into town, and she tells all the people that she knows, hey, come meet a guy who just told me everything that I ever did, which is an interesting way to share the gospel. But it shows that she somehow is no longer afraid of the truth. Isn't that awesome? What happened? A life was changed. How did that life get changed? Here's the key. It happened when truth was communicated in an atmosphere of grace. You know why I think a lot of people come to this church and stay here? And if it's your first time here, I hope we live up to this. You know, pastors and church leaders are talking forever about how we can have a seeker-sensitive church, right? Ever heard of that expression? We want to be seeker-sensitive. So when seekers come, we're sensitive to them. I get a constant barrage of ads on my Facebook feed about how to make my church more seeker-sensitive. Meaning, how do we welcome people who are just kind of checking out Jesus and Christianity and the church, or maybe people that went away and have come back after a long time? So what does that require? How do you have a seeker-sensitive church? Do you have to have perfectly polished music? Expensive lighting? What about a super cool kids program and a rockin' youth group? That helps. Sure, it helps. How about an attractive and user-friendly website? That helps. Okay, good. But what if there's too much thinking there? Is it possible? Just play with me here. Is it possible that the most seeker-sensitive thing you can have in a church is simply an atmosphere of grace? I think in large measure that's what attracts people to you guys. Because you're weird, but you're gracious. You know? People know they can come here and they will not get the third degree. They're not going to get judged the minute they walk in the door. If they look a little bit different than us, then so what? If the guitar player starts the song in the wrong key, not that that ever happens, Jesse, the worship service doesn't come apart at the seams, right? If the pastor gets sick and runs out the door in the middle of the sermon, people graciously step in and they fill the gap. And by the way, I have not had to field one question of, why did you even dare to go up there when you knew you were sick? And I didn't expect that question because I know you guys are a gracious bunch. Thank you. This is a place where there's grace in abundance. And that means, and here's the key, it means it's also a place where people can encounter the truth, even the truth about themselves, and not be overcome with shame. After all, when it comes to feeling inadequate, we're all in the same boat. That's what we mean by compassion and authenticity. If you look at our core values over here above the door, they work together, compassion and authenticity, grace and truth. That's one of the most important things that we can offer this community, and we need to guard that because we have it now, and we need to get better at it. A place where you can open up to God and others without fear. I describe this church as that lots. It's a place where you can be yourself in front of God and other people. But it's not just in the church setting that I'm talking about. It works in our individual lives too. When people, no matter who it is, when people who are in an atmosphere of grace, they can find the courage sometimes to face the truth. Do you need to heal a broken relationship? Have there been misunderstandings, even some accusations leveled? Establish an atmosphere of grace. What does that mean? It means forgiveness. It means open communication. It means acceptance. It means openness about your own struggles. It means looking past the sharp words that were spoken in the heat of the moment and not recording them for all time in your brain. And then, in that context, when that is settled and that atmosphere is there, then you can begin to speak the truth. Are you trying to be a good parent to a struggling or rebellious child? You're not sure where to start? You start with an atmosphere of grace and you speak the truth. Grace where there's permission to be imperfect. Are you trying to mentor another believer? Speak the truth in an atmosphere of grace, which means, in this case, owning up to your own weaknesses and sins when necessary. Are you hoping to share Christ this Christmas with someone who doesn't know him? Speak the truth in an atmosphere of grace. We're always trying to change people, you know? And that's okay. People need to be changed. We're always trying to get people to change. But the problem is we do it in one way or the other usually, right? Either we bombard them with truth. Here's the truth. And when they don't respond, we say, why don't they get it? Why can't they get it through their thick head? Well, they don't want to get it because you're choking them with truth. And there's no grace, so they don't have the room to face the issues. Or we're so nice and we're so non-judgmental and we never say a difficult word and we let everything pass and we wonder why they're not changing. Well, why should they? Nobody's had the courage to tell them the truth. And most of us, I know, tend to identify ourselves either as truth tellers or grace givers, right? I could have a show of hands right now. How many of you are truth tellers and how many of you are grace givers? And we tend to specialize. And I agree that we probably all have a natural bent in that area, one way or the other. But the truth is that God calls us to be both, because Jesus was both. Why do we have to be both? Well, because people can change when they're presented with truth in a safe and forgiving and accepting atmosphere, an atmosphere of grace. That's when change happens. And that's the atmosphere that God has provided for you in Jesus Christ, if you think about it, the one who embodied the entire truth of the Old Testament and the radical grace in God's heart, Jesus Christ. Don't be afraid to open up to him today because he loves you.